I should mention that the de Broglie-Bohm interpretation that we covered previously, it was the origin of Bell's theorem. So Bell noticed the non-locality in the de Broglie-Bohm theory and wondered whether every model of quantum theory would have that feature. And that's how he was led to his theorem. Let me also mention the connection with what we were talking about last time. So last time we talked about these psi epistemic ontological models. And we showed that you could derive them, you could derive theories that reproduced a large part of quantum theory in the sense of reproducing the operational predictions just by taking the principle that you have a restriction on how much you know. And so in that approach, non-orthogonal quantum states get represented by overlapping distributions. And I tried to convince you that a lot of the phenomena that we usually think of as quintessentially quantum come out in these theories, which are essentially classical theories with a restriction on how much you know. So you have classical type explanations of these, of the central features of these phenomena. But I mentioned that there were some other phenomena that were not part of those fragments of quantum theory. And so Bell inequality violations is one example, something called contextuality that we'll come to next lecture. Quantum computational speedup was another example. And I'll mention just that if you look at certain more nuanced aspects of these phenomena, not the things that people typically point to as being mysterious about them, you can also show that those aspects fall in this category. So today we're going to be talking about Bell's theorem. So it's going to be an example of something that you can't recover in the way that we saw yesterday, just by taking the quantum state to be a representation of what we know about some underlying classical reality. Okay. So my objective for most of today is going to be to try to present Bell's theorem in a way that it becomes very intuitive to you. So rather than a lot of formalism, I'm going to try to make it extremely intuitive. So the best way to do that is by thinking of it as a two-party game. And so what we're going to have, this is just my notation now, is two types of measurements. They're going to be labeled H and T. They're going to be determined by the outcome of a coin flip, heads and tails. And each of the measurements has just two outcomes, which will be red and green. And we have the standard setup. So we imagine that there's a pair of particles that are prepared in the middle, sent off to the two devices, and they get measured both in the H measurement, or H on the left, T on the right, T on the left, H on the right, or T on both sides. And that's determined. Each one of those choices is determined at random at the two ends. So each of these four possibilities occurs with probability a quarter. And then you register the statistics. So to give you a feel for what's surprising about the statistics that we see in Bell's theorem, I want to actually challenge you to generate certain kinds of statistics, certain kinds of correlations. So it's easier if we actually do it as a two-party game. So I need two contestants to volunteer to try to solve the puzzle. And I know everyone's reluctant, so you can keep the coin at the end that we're going to flip. So there's a cash prize for anyone who's bold enough to volunteer. But I do need two volunteers. Who's up for it? All right, Matt? Excellent. Come on down. And I'm also going to need two helpers. So Aggie can, there's no money in it, so sadly, but there's also no pressure. Okay, so you guys stand in the middle. You're the two particles, okay? You're one of the measurement devices. This is your coin to flip. And I need one other helper. And somebody, yeah, excellent, thank you. I'll give you a coin to flip as well. All right, and here's how it's going to work. So, right. If you turn around and take a look here, this is your challenge. So it's the setup I described. and the two particles are going to make a plan initially. They're going to go off to the wings. A coin's going to be flipped. And that's going to determine what measurement's happening on you. It's just the heads or the tails measurement. And then you have to respond with an outcome, red or green. And the rules of the game is that if it happens that the coins come up the same, so you're both being measured in the same way, then the outcomes you report should agree. And if the coins come up different, so that different measurements are being made on you, then your outcomes should disagree. Okay, so you don't get to communicate with one another once you're at the stations, right? If I had soundproof booths, we would use them, but we don't. So we'll just be watching to make sure that you don't communicate with one another. So Jessica, for example, you're not going to know whether it was heads or tails over there. You're just going to know whether it was heads or tails here. So you guys need to talk it over and say, okay, here's our plan. You know, if I get heads, I'll answer green. And if I get tails, I'll answer red. And you, if you get red, you'll do this. And if you get heads, you'll do this. If you get tails, you'll do that. So that you need a plan. And then what we're going to do is just, again, so that there's no communication across the room, I'm going to give each of the measurement devices a piece of paper and a pen. And after they flip their coin, they're just going to write down, rather than telling you the outcome of the coin flip, so nobody can hear what the outcome of the coin flip was, they're just going to write down H or T on the paper. And then you respond by taking the pen and writing down R or G for red or green. So is it clear how the game is going to run? Yes, OK. So now take some time. You guys can converse, make a plan. After it's all done, I'm going to collect the cards. I'm going to see if you satisfy these rules. If you do, you win the dollar. And if you don't, you don't win the dollar. And then meanwhile, everybody else should figure out how to win this game. So take a couple of minutes. You're ready. OK, off to your stations. All right, and now we have coin flips. And then write it down. Write the outcome of the coin flip on the paper so that we have a record of it. We'll collect the answers. Nope, just once.
Just once?
Just once. All right, excellent. So on the right, it was tails. The answer was green. On the left, it was heads. The answer was green.
It's green.
Heads was red.
Heads was red. OK, so. What was your strategy? I think your strategy was correct. Can you explain your strategy?
Heads was red and tails was green.
Right, for both of you, that's the idea. If let's say you answer, your strategy was to answer green for heads and reds for tails, and the other person does the same, then you're supposed to agree when it's both heads or both tails, and you're supposed to disagree when they're different. Your strategy was good. I think you should get rewarded 50 cents each for having the correct strategy. here's your prize.
Game show?
Yeah, you missed the game show. All right, you can sit down. Thank you. So yeah, that was pretty easy.
Are you playing like quantum games or?
Yeah, something like that. So pretty straightforward to satisfy the winning condition for this game. Let me give you another one. We don't have to play this one as a game show, but see if you can solve this one. So same setup. Whenever... wait a second. Did I get that right? Yeah. Yes. So whenever the same measurement is made on the two particles, then their outcomes are supposed to disagree. And whenever different measurements are made, their outcomes should agree. So in the past, it was agree here, disagree here. So what's the strategy that wins that game?
One person says tails is green, another person says heads is green.
Exactly, and then for the opposite result, they choose the opposite color. So if, for example, you've got the scheme where the person on the right answers red for heads, green for tails, the person on the left answers green for heads and red for tails, then you'll see that you have disagreement when they've got the same measurement, which is what the game asked, and you'll have agreement when they have different measurements, which was, again, the winning condition in the game. So you'll always win the game in this case. Okay, so now let me give you scenario three. This is a good one, so there's also a dollar to be won here for anyone who can see the winning strategy. So now if the T measurement is made on both systems, then the outcomes should disagree. But otherwise, for the other three measurements, heads and heads, heads and tails, or tails and heads, the outcomes have to agree. The question is, what's the winning strategy for this game?
Like an entangled pair of photons.
So were the other two like just games you can find a winning strategy classically?
Well, we did find a winning strategy in the last two games.
Classically, right?
It was the key fact about it was that
you can agree on the strategy beforehand.
There was a common cause explanation, right? We had some local instructions about what we would do for mm-hmm. every eventuality, mm-hmm. and that was sufficient to win the game. Mm. So what about here?
think you can find a winning strategy. Because right. If you get heads, you really don't know where the other person got tails or heads.
Can you prove? Can you prove that there's no winning strategy?
I think you would go with from there, from heads.
Right. Yes. Does anybody think there is a winning strategy?
But classically?
Classically, yeah.
Oh, classically, I don't think so.
You have a proof?
Yeah.
Okay, let's hear it.
Can I draw?
Yeah, sure.
So, assuming the only thing you can call it is that you got tails or heads yourself.
Right.
So, your decision point will be based on tails or heads.
Yes.
So, this is the second person, and these are all possible outcomes. Say here, so say this person said
red for heads. Yeah. This person has to say the same thing.
Heads
and tails. Yes. They disagree. That means they have said the exact same thing here and here. But then
he said the same thing here and here.
And
he said the same
thing here and here. So that this time is consistent. I don't think I quite followed that. Maybe it'd be helpful if you said, like, let's say these guys are red. I think you said these guys, suppose these guys are
okay,
both
yeah.
Red.
So say, and then
okay.
You want this to
reset these both. Green, yeah, okay. And then what's
that,
the next step?
Which means that he said this dice is the same
right.
Color for head and tails. So
yeah, that's all green. That has to be green, yeah, okay.
And then this guy over here, presumably, says the same color for tails. So it doesn't matter what color it is.
It'll disagree on one of those lines.
Disagree,
yeah. Good. That is deed approved. So you win the dollar. Well done. Yes, the lucrative day. So yeah, there is. If we had run this game, there would be no strategy that would win all the time. So this is the same proof that you just showed that, in fact, you know, no matter what I choose as an outcome here, green or red, if I just follow through and say, okay, well, heads on the other side has to agree in its outcome, and then across the top I have to have agreement, and across the other diagonal I have to have agreement, and then I get contradiction with the desideratum to have disagreement here. And you can verify that all 2^4 possibilities for colorings for those four measurements fail to satisfy all four of these constraints. Okay, it's a frustrated network. There's no way that you can have 3 agreements and 1 disagreement among 4 variables. Okay, so it can't be done. What's the highest probability with which you can win this game out of all strategies? 50?
75? 3 out of 4.
3 out of 4, why is that?
Just always agree.
Yep, this is a strategy that wins at 3/4 of the time because it achieves agreement. Remember, each of the 4 configurations that are on the board occur with probability 1/4. That was one of the assumptions, because the coin flips are assumed to be fair. So in this particular strategy, you win 3/4 of the time, and you only lose when it happens to be TT. And again, you know, if you just, it's clear that because it's a frustrated network, at most you can satisfy 3 of those constraints and not 4. Okay, so you can win at most 75% of the time by local strategies. So if we imagine that the particles in an experiment are determining the outcomes of the measurements based on some properties, and those properties are correlated, those are like local strategies, right? Like what we did here is just an elaborate way of imagining that, you know, particles have some, you know, internal degrees of freedom, some memory. They can carry off to the devices. They can make the devices respond in certain ways and generate correlations that way. So you would expect that the particles could only win 75% of the time based on what we just described. But quantum mechanics predicts that they can win roughly 85% of the time. So it's actually a half plus 1 over 2 root 2, which is roughly 85%. So that's the puzzle. And experiments corroborate quantum theory, and you can get better than 75% success at this kind of game. So now let's think about ways that the particles could do this. Or in fact, let's imagine that we had done this here with, you know, two contestants, and suppose we'd done the game many times, okay? And so we developed some statistics. So we get a sense of how often these contestants win. And suppose we observe that they win 85% of the time, okay? What would we conclude? Like, clearly, they must be cheating in some way. So what would their cheating, possible cheating strategies look like?
Telling one another what they got.
Exactly, right. If there was a communication of what the measurement was at one wing to the particle at the other wing, then clearly, they could get it right. So for example, if, go back here. Yeah, if the party on the right managed to communicate to the particle on the left, whether it was heads or tails, then the particle on the left could decide to answer green for the tails if it was heads over there, and red if it was tails over there, and thereby achieve all the constraints in the problem.
Yeah, doing that though, and they only win 85% of the time, I'm starting to suspect how did they get into the side program? Like, why are they winning only 85% of the time?
Good question. In fact, I would say that's a lot of contemporary work on Bell non-locality is trying to answer that exact question. So for a long time in quantum foundations, people were focused on how could quantum theory possibly do better than 75%? And the more modern work is saying, why isn't it more than 85%? Why is it precisely 85%? Why isn't it 100% of the time? Why don't we have more non-locality than we see in quantum mechanics? And so the kinds of things that Lucien's been talking about, axiom schemes, there are various attempts at axiom schemes to try to hit exactly the quantum amount of non-locality. So there's many candidate axioms. And it's a popular topic. But for now, let's just focus on how could you win this game greater than 75% of the time. So one way is with communication. What other schemes, what other cheating strategies could you use?
Affect whether it's heads or tails.
Yeah.
You, like the person who's flipping the coin.
You could bribe the person who's flipping the coin. Yeah, if you had some sort of pre-established conspiracy in the sense that, you know, maybe the coins aren't in fact random, maybe the outcomes of the coins are correlated in some way, or the players know what the sequence of outcomes is going to be, then they can win the game because they know what they're going to get. So let's go through those. So rig the choice, so that's one of them. Rig the game so that the choices and settings are not random, but instead are correlated with these local strategies, or communicate the choice of the measurement in one wing to the system in the opposite wing. This possibility here. So one interesting fact is that you can do this experiment in the following way. You can put the two measurement devices very far away from one another. So the particles fly after the measurement devices. They use photons. And choose the measurement randomly very quickly and register the outcome immediately thereafter. And if you do this quickly enough, you make the choice and register the outcome in a short period of time, you can make it so that even if a signal propagated from the left wing at the speed of light out towards the right-hand wing after the measurement is chosen, it still doesn't have time to get the message to the other particle before the other particle has to register its outcome. So if you think that any communication would have to be subliminal because of relativity theory, then it seems like this sort of cheating strategy is not available in an experiment that's done this way. Okay, so that's the challenge. How is it that quantum experiments can violate Bell inequalities? So let's go through a few of the details. So first question for you. Suppose the particles had access to randomness when deciding on their strategy. So imagine our two players here had, you know, flipped some coins to make some decisions using randomness rather than making deterministic strategies. Would that have helped them win the game? No. because ultimately, all they could do is choose one of the 2 to the 4 possible strategies, you know, colors for each of the possible measurement outcomes. And every one of those only wins the game with at most probability 75%. So any probabilistic mixture of them is also only going to win the game with probability at most 75%. OK, next question. If the particles have access to local randomness, so what I mean is, suppose that you don't flip your coins here, but you wait till you get to the devices, you flip your coin when you get to the devices, after maybe you've seen whether it's heads or tails, does that help? Why not?
It's still not correlated.
I'm sorry?
You're still not correlated.
You're still not correlated?
Even if it's local randomness, it's probably uncorrelated local randomness.
Yes, it'll definitely, if they're flipping independent coins, it's uncorrelated.
Unless
what?
You correlate the probability distributions, in which will be like, you know, you can make a...
So you're thinking that if they had coins mm-hmm. that somehow were correlated, that might help?
Yeah.
Why?
Because then it would not be exactly 50. Yeah, I mean, they...
Well, let me point out that the strategy wherein they were mm-hmm. flipping the coins initially is like what you just described. If we flip one coin and say, okay, you know, now we know there's random outcome, we both take note of it and we go off, you have correlated randomness. And that was the case where we said it wasn't going to help because at most they could just do mixtures of the strategies that only get 75%. So local randomness also doesn't help because again, you know, you could have imagined flipping those coins initially. You know, we flip some coins, I take the outcomes of these coin flips, you take the outcomes of those coin flips, we go off. It doesn't matter that it's happening on the wings. At the end of the day, it's still just going to be a mixture. Ultimately, there's going to be some answers given, and it's just a mixture of possibilities of answers. But whatever choice of answers you give, you can only win the game at most 75%. So this doesn't help either. So there was some thoughts in the early days after Bell's theorem that perhaps giving up determinism allowed you to salvage locality. But that's not the case, that this result goes through and says there's no local instruction set that can explain the correlations, even if you grant that the outcomes are not determined by the properties of the particles. That doesn't matter. You still can't generate these correlations. Okay, next question. So detectors in these experiments typically have inefficiencies, which means sometimes they just register no outcome at all. So like in an experiment with photons, it can happen that you just don't detect any photons at all. And if the inefficiencies are high, meaning the rate of no detections is high, the question is, can particles that are using local instruction sets simulate the correlations, so win the game, if we only look at the cases where the particles were detected? So the idea is we run this experiment. Some of the times, over here on the right, the particle doesn't get detected. We don't get an outcome. Some of the times on the left, some of the times maybe they both don't deliver outcomes. So now we just keep the cases where we got outcomes for both particles. And we ask, has the winning condition been satisfied in all those cases? And the question is, if we look at just those cases, could it be that they satisfy the winning condition even though they're using these local strategies? So ponder that for a minute.
So whether an outcome is registered or not depends on something or absolutely nothing. Is it random or?
Well, you could consider each case. So suppose that whether the outcome is registered or not were totally random, independent of the states of the particles, then it wouldn't seem to make a difference because it's just going to be a random selection of the runs in which the detectors don't fire. And so for the rest of the runs, you'd expect to see the same thing we always expect, which is you can only win this game at most 75%. If the particles are using local strategies. So the question then becomes, what if the detector's not firing is a function of the state of the particles.
If it's just one detector that doesn't work, or that doesn't, if the right-hand detector there didn't register any tails, then you would win 100% of the time. If you just both agreed to always say the same answer.
It was this one, you mean the left one?
So if the right-hand side,
yep.
If whenever he gets tails, he just, it doesn't work.
Yep.
Then, and they agree to say the same thing all the time.
Okay.
The only thing they'll register is correct answers.
Do you mean this person's going to answer red all the time, but this person's just going to answer nothing for tails, like, you know, no detection?
And then, yeah.
Yep. So, yeah, if the state of the particle was such that, you know, when I get to the right-hand detector, if it says heads, I'll answer green. And I know that whatever the left-hand particle gets will satisfy the winning condition, right? Because I know that the left-hand, we've agreed that the left-hand particle is always going to answer red. But if the right-hand measurement device says tails, I'm just going to say no detection. I'm going to cause the detector to fail to register. And so they can always do that. They can always make the detectors fail to register in circumstances where, you know, they're worried that they're going to get caught and not win the game. So that's right. That ultimately, if the no detection events are a function of the states of the particles, then the particles can always win the game on the events where the particle is detected. So that's called the detection loophole. So if we're doing this experiment and our detector inefficiencies are too high, right, the rate of no detections is high enough, then seeing these correlations is not evidence of a failure of the existence of these local instruction sets, because we can imagine that the particles are cheating in this way by determining when the no detection events happen. Okay, so if you want to do an experimental test, you've got to make sure that your detectors have high enough efficiency. And of course, if the choice of measurement on the two wings is made too early, right? So remember this diagram. So if I don't have a way of generating a random measurement choice quickly, so that this is sort of far in the past, and then it's possible that there's a causal influence that can reach the outcome on the other wing. So you need to make sure that those choices are done very quickly. And so this is a problem, and it's called the locality loophole. If you can't make your experiment far enough apart and the measurement choice is fast enough, then you have room for subluminal communication between the two wings. So these were the two main challenges for, or the two main loopholes for tests of Bell's theorem. And prior to 2015, they were individually closed, but there was no experiment that closed them together. And then in 2015, there were three experiments that reported results around the same time that sealed both the loopholes. That's basically the easy way to seal this loophole is to use photons, but photons have poor detector efficiencies, but the efficiencies of detectors improved a lot, and so it finally became possible to do a loophole-free test of Bell's theorem. So that's up till now. Everything we've said had nothing to do with quantum theory. It was just about what kinds of correlations you can generate using these local instruction sets, using common causes in the way that we set up. So now let's talk about how it is that quantum theory manages to do better. This is the example we've been talking about. The probability of success in the game is just the probability of getting agreement for the heads, 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 tails, tails, heads, and disagreement for the tails, tails, where each of those conditions occurs with probability a quarter. And this notion of locality tells me that the probability of success should be less than or equal to 75%. That's an example of a Bell inequality. So the thing on the left-hand side is just a function of operational statistics. So these probabilities, you know, the probability that I'll get green, green, or red, red when the settings were heads and heads, is just something I can measure as a relative frequency when I run this experiment. And so all of these things I can just pull out of the data from my experiment and plug them into this inequality and see if they violate it or not. And so quantum theory, as I said, predicts that you can get 1/2 plus 1 over 2 root 2 in this experiment. So here's how you can do it. Suppose you prepare the pair of states initially to be in this entangled state, 0, 0 plus 1, 1, with equal amplitudes. And then over here on the left, so this is a picture of a plane of the Bloch sphere, the ZX plane. So for the heads outcome, you measure the X poly operator. For the tails outcome, you measure the Z poly operator. If you get the plus outcome, you answer green. Minus outcome, you answer red. And over here, it's a different pair of axes in the Bloch sphere, which are separated from 45 degrees from these ones. So this is like measuring along the Z plus X over root 2 direction and the Z minus X over root 2 direction. So so you're trying to generate these correlations, and the claim is that you can do that 85% of the time. Here's how it works. So first of all, if I measure on the left-hand side along some direction n on the Bloch sphere for this quantum state, suppose n is just an angle theta from the z-axis, then it corresponds to this quantum state here, where 0 and 1 are the z eigenstates. So I take the overlap of this quantum state with the entangled state, and I just get the corresponding amplitudes for the states on B. So cos theta over 2, 0, plus sine theta over 2, 1. And that's just because this thing had only real amplitudes, and I always get the same real amplitude state on the B system if I measure it on the A system. So that's just the plus N state on system B. And now if I ask what's the probability of getting the plus N state on A and the plus M state on B, I just take the overlap of N and M with psi. But because N acting on psi takes me to N on B, that's just the overlap between M and N squared. So that's the probability of seeing these two outcomes. And if, in particular, this guy was on the z-axis and this guy was off at some angle theta, that would just give me cos squared theta over 2. And in fact, it only depends on the angle between the two. So for these cases, like if I do the t measurement here and the t measurement here, or actually, no, let me take heads here and heads here, what's the probability I'll get the green outcome in both cases? Well, that's n is this vector, m is this vector. They're separated by 45 degrees. And cos squared of pi over 8 is just 1/2 plus 1 over 2 over 2. So that's where the 85% comes from. If I if I consider all the other cases, like suppose I got the red outcome for heads over here, what's the probability I'll get the red outcome for heads here? Well, that's 45 degrees separated from this, so it's again 85%. And you can run through, if I heads green and tails green, 45 degree angle between them, so 85%. The one exception is the T measurement. There, you expect the outcomes to be anti-correlated 85% of the time because it's the red outcome of T that's 45 separated from the green outcome of T over here. So what you see just from the geometry is that for the heads-heads, heads-tails, tails-heads configuration, you expect agreement of the outcomes about 85% of the time. But for the TT configuration, you expect disagreement 85% of the time. And so that's why your probability of success is just always 85%. Questions about that? Another important thing to notice about the quantum experiment, and I haven't mentioned this explicitly so far, is that there isn't any signaling from the left to the right. So first of all, a little warning. I've changed notation. A and B was a name for the two particles. Now it's the names of outcomes. So X and Y are names of settings. A and B are names of outcomes. So suppose I do any POVM you like over here on the left. It has an outcome labeled by A, so it's lots of different POVM elements, perhaps, as I range over the values of A. There's lots of different possible POVMs I could do. That's as I range over the values of X. Similarly, over here on the right. And if I just ask, what's the probability of getting some outcome B on the right when I, given y and given x. It's just going to be this, right? It's the probability of getting the outcomes a and b given x and y summed over a. So I just marginalize over a. I don't care about that outcome. But this joint probability of a and b given x and y, that's just given by quantum mechanics. It's the Born rule. Take the quantum state of the pair of particles. That's rho. Take the tensor product of the POVM elements, trace it, and sum over a. That's how I get this probability distribution. But if I pull the sum over a inside the trace, I know a POVM always has its elements summed to identity. So this just gives me identity on the first system. And that means that this expression doesn't depend on x at all. So it doesn't matter what POVM you're measuring, the sum over the outcomes always gives me identity, so the x dependence drops out. I get that the probability of b depends only on y, not on x. And so that means that by changing the value of x over here on the left, I do not influence the statistics of outcomes on b. And so in particular, if there was such an influence, if the statistics of b changed even a little bit, I could encode zeros and ones. I could like run the experiment a million times with x in one setting, and then run it a million times with x in the other setting. And you know, which of those two settings it was would influence the statistics. You could measure those statistics, and you could learn whether it's a zero or a one I'm trying to communicate to you. But this says that there's no dependence of the statistics, and so there's no possibility of sending any signals from here to here. So notice that, you know, we've assumed that the way you model these measurements is as something non-trivial tensor identity, so that the measurement over here is identity on this particle, and the measurement over here acts as identity on the first particle. And that's because we are assuming these things are space-like separated, and that's how we should model measurements. So the idea here is that, you know, normally if I wanted to build no signaling into my quantum theory, I would say, well, let's make sure we don't allow Hamiltonians that would, you know, allow things to couple any faster than the speed of light. But then there's still a worry that, oh, well, maybe, you know, even all the Hamiltonians only describe subluminal influences, maybe this strange remote collapse of the wave function provides a mechanism for sending signals faster than the speed of light. This calculation is meant to show that's not the case, that this remote collapse of the wave function does not help you send signals faster than light. There's no possibility of signaling. So now you have this interesting sort of tension. On the one hand, you can't send signals from the setting to the outcome over here. But on the other hand, one reading of Bell's theorem is to say, well, we couldn't get away with a common cause explanation. So aren't we forced to say that there must have been some superluminal influence between the two wings? And now the question is, well, if there's this superluminal influence, why can't we use it to signal? Okay, so just a couple of other things I wanted to note that what happens if instead of this setup here, I give you a state that's not perfectly maximally entangled? So maybe it's a convex mixture of that state and a product state, with a small weight for the product state. What do you think happens in that case? Are we going to see correlations that suddenly satisfy the Bell inequality? No.
It probably changes continuously in your probabilities.
Exactly. So, you know, as I perturb away from this state, I'm just going to get that this thing is a small perturbation away from 85%, but it still violates that 75% bound. And so I don't need perfection here. I can have a mixed state. And in fact, I can add quite a bit of noise because I have a 10% gap between 85% and 75%. So that's why I can actually, you know, do, like, no experiment ever achieved truly pure quantum states. And so that's why these sorts of tests are robust to experimental noise and imperfections. So you can still violate the Bell inequality. And it's the same thing if I have imperfections in my measurements. If they're not precisely the projective measurements we're talking about here, but maybe slightly noisy versions of those guys, it amounts to the same thing, because I could think of a noisy measurement as a perfect measurement preceded by some noise, but I could always have thought of that noise as acting on the bipartite state to begin with anyhow. And again, just by continuity, you know, as I go towards perfect measurements, I'm definitely going to get 85%. So there's lots of room for noise in the measurements as well. I can still violate these inequalities. Good. So I want to say a few things about what a sort of more modern perspective on Bell's theorem involving something called the framework of causal models. So we talked in the lecture on operationalism about, you know, one of the criticisms of operationalism, it doesn't give you a causal story of what's going on. But there is a framework from statistics that's been developed in the last 20 years or so that allows you to formalize notions of causal structure. So I want to say what that framework says about Bell's theorem. So remember, the question is, you know, if I have an experiment and I see some data, can I offer a particular causal explanation of that data? So you'll remember Simpson's paradox. I was trying to persuade you that if you just give me a data table, there's more to be said. You know, the question is, how did those correlations get generated? Was it a common cause explanation or maybe a direct cause-effect relation? So you see that in our analysis of Bell's theorem, we saw that, you know, our setup of the game was an attempt at a common cause explanation. We were forbidding cause-effect relations, which would be those communication channels. And it seemed like the common cause explanation was insufficient to explain the correlations. But let me start with a different example that we saw previously, which is this kind of data table. So it's not one of the games we played. Those should be, say, 0.5. Right? This is what the data table should look like. So if the settings are both zero, so that was like what we called heads-heads, then I get agreement. And if they're both tails, or both one in this case, I get agreement. And the rest of the time, they're just uncorrelated, uniform mixture over all possible pairs of outcomes. So this is what you get if you set up this experiment, where you measure, say, Z or X on the left and Z or X on the right, and you have this maximally entangled state. Because if I do the Z measurement here, I collapse to the 0 or 1, and then the distant guy gets collapsed to the same state, so I'll get perfect correlation with Z. But if I measure in the X basis, then I'm using the plus or minus state, then I'm collapsing the other guy to plus or minus, so I'll get perfect correlation here. So the outcomes are going to agree. But if I, for example, measure the Z basis here and the X basis here, whatever outcome I get, I collapse to one of these two points, and each of these two points makes this measurement totally random. So whether I got up or down is totally random for this state, because the reduction on A is completely mixed. And then the outcome of X I get is totally random for each outcome. So it's just a quarter probability for all the options. And therefore, those sorts of configurations are totally uncorrelated. And that's what we see here, right? That's these uncorrelated guys. So this case does allow a common cause explanation. And that's what we saw in these fragments of quantum theory we talked about last time. If I imagine that each particle has four internal states, 1, 2, 3, 4, and they're perfectly correlated, which means they're either both 1 or both 2 or both 3 or both 4, chosen at random. And then I imagine that the two measurements on each wing are just partitioning that set of four states into two sets of two in two different ways. You know, so let's count them 1, 2, 3, 4. So this partitions them into 1, 2, and 3, 4. This partitions them into 1, 3, and 2, 4. The point is that if I do the same measurement on the two sides, then because the properties are perfectly correlated, I'll see correlation. If I do this measurement and this measurement, I'll see correlation. But if I do this measurement and this measurement, the different measurements of the two wings, then they won't be correlated. So if I find that the left-hand guy is in the top, he could be on the left or the right, and so it's totally random whether I get the left or right outcome on the right. So that's a common cause explanation using some, you know, coin flipping at the beginning to decide which of the strategies, which generates exactly this data table. And so this is exactly the EPR experiment. What I showed you here, that's what Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen were describing. They were using particle position momentum, but this is the spin or qubit version of that experiment. And there's no need for any non-local influence. So that's why Einstein was arguing, you know, this, if you want an explanation of this just in terms of common causes, which is what you'd expect if they're space-like separated, then you'd better admit that quantum state updating is just updating of our knowledge of the distance system. But what Bell's theorem showed is that if I take this other data table here, which is the one that you generate with this setup that I told you about. So you'll notice that the probability of agreement is just the sum of getting both zero outcomes or both one outcome. So that's where the 85% comes from. And down here, it's the probability of disagreement that's 85%. What we just showed is that this kind of explanation is not possible. And so So, you know, the situation is that I think Einstein's argument that the EPR experiment does not require any superluminal causation is absolutely right. But Bell's theorem is harder to get around. There are some cases where you can't just think of this in terms of a common cause and probabilistic dependencies of your outcomes on your settings and your variables. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about what the causal model's formalism says about this. So what is the formalism? So a causal model is consists of two parts. It's a causal structure. So that is a directed acyclic graph. So the nodes of the graph are random variables, right? They can take any number, some number of values. And the directed edges correspond to direct causal influences. So in this formalism, there's a difference between a direct causal influence, so like T to X, that's a direct causal influence, or an indirect causal influence, T to X via Y. The model also specifies some parameters. So for each variable, you specify the probability distribution over its values given its parents. So W, S, and T, for example, have no parents. So I specify their probability distributions on their own. Whereas Y, for example, has W and T as parents. So for every choice of values of T and W, I need to specify the probability distribution over Y's values. X has all the other guys as parents, so I need to specify this conditional as well. And if you work out what joint distribution over all the variables do I expect to see if this is the causal structure, it's straightforward to show that it's just the product of these distributions. So you just sample W, S, and T, and then you sample Y given the values of T and W that you sampled, and you sample X given the values of the others, and that will give you a sample of all the variables. Okay, so that's how you can connect up the causal structure to the observed correlations between a set of variables. There's something called causal inference, which is just the inverse problem. So I give you a joint distribution over some variables, and it's your job to tell me what sorts of causal models could have given rise to that distribution. What sorts of directed acyclic graphs and parameters might have generated that distribution. Now, I've just given you an example here. In general, we imagine that what's given might be a distribution over some subset of the variables that are causally relevant. So it could be that some of these variables, like T, for example, it might not even be observed. It might be what's called a latent variable. And so you're still trying to assess whether, for example, X and Y have a common cause, even though you're not measuring that variable. Right? There could be indications of that in the distribution. Okay, and there's two basic principles that go into these algorithms for causal inference. There's a whole literature on this. There's lots of sophisticated algorithms. I'm going to tell you almost nothing about those algorithms except the two important principles that go into them, because that's all I'm going to need to tell you what the significance for Bell's theorem is. So the first principle is that if you see statistical dependencies, so if you see correlations, then they need to be explained causally. So that's already been encoded in the definition of the model, because you'll notice that we didn't allow, for example, a joint distribution over W, S, and T. We demanded that each one of them has its own distribution such that the overall distribution factorizes. And the reason is that we're saying, look, if there is some correlation between S and T, for example, then I have to encode that in the causal structure. We will not allow correlations that are not explained causally. So if I want to force correlations between S and T, then I better put a cause-effect relation between these guys, or maybe a common cause between these guys. So the idea here, so this is sometimes called Reichenbach's principle. And the idea is that if, you know, for example, two variables are correlated, it's either because there's a cause-effect influence one way or the other way, or a common cause, or maybe a common cause and a cause-effect influence acting simultaneously. But those are the only ways that we explain correlations. Good. To tell you about the second principle, I need to just give you like a little test on causal inference. So this is a very simple causal inference problem for you. So suppose you've observed three variables. You've got their joint distribution from the statistics. And you notice that A is independent of B. So that means that if you compute the marginal distribution on A and B by summing over all values of C, you find that it factorizes. Okay, so if you ignore C, then A teaches you nothing about B. And that's it. That's the only independence relation that's in the data. So in particular, if you know B and C are correlated, A and C are correlated, and if I condition on C, A and B are still correlated. So it's only when I ignore C that they become uncorrelated. And so the question becomes, what is the natural causal structure that explains this pattern? Yep.
A and B influencing C.
Exactly. It's this DAG. Because, first of all, if it had been the opposite, if C had been a common cause of A and B, then generically I would expect them to be correlated, but they're uncorrelated. Similarly, if there was any influences between A and B, then I would expect them to be correlated. But if they're influencing C, then by Reichenbach's principle, they should be independent because they each have no parents. So the causal model assumes that they start out in independent distributions. And it also matches the fact I told you that A and B are correlated if you condition on C. That also holds true here. But if I condition on a joint effect of two variables, I tend to make them correlated. Like, for example, if C is the output of an AND gate, and A and B are bits that I put in the AND gate, then when I learn that C has value 0, well, then A and B are either both 0 or 0, 1 or 1, 0. But the point is they're now correlated, right? You tell me about one, I can learn something about the other. So that's the natural causal explanation of what's going on. But it turns out there's another logically possible explanation, which is this one. It's one that you wouldn't have expected. Like, there's a common cause and a cause-effect relation. And the trick is that there's a way of choosing the parameters in this model. So remember, the parameters are a conditional distribution for every variable given its parents. There's a way of choosing the parameters in this model so that I just achieve this independence. So heuristically, you could say, well, what if A and B are positively correlated by virtue of the cause-effect relation, and they're negatively correlated by virtue of the common cause, and those two things just cancel out so that A and B become uncorrelated. So this is called a fine-tuned model. So it's a possible explanation of what we've seen. But the big difference is that here, no matter what parameters I lay down in the model, I always achieve this independence. Whereas here, there's only a set of measure zero of choices of the parameters that will achieve what I've seen. So the idea is that if only a set of measure zero of the parameters achieve the explanation, it's a bad explanation because it's fine-tuned. So that's the second principle that usually goes into these models, that you shouldn't, that fine-tuned explanations are bad explanations. Okay, so you can ask, what do these sorts of models tell me about the Bell correlations? You know, what kinds of causal relations among A, B, X, and Y could possibly give rise to that? We saw from the first half of the lecture that this explanation is not gonna work because I can't achieve 85% agreement and disagreement in these cases. So that's not an option. But now here's the interesting thing, that if I say, well, okay, then I'm gonna have to grant that there's some causal influence from the setting on the left to the outcome on the right. So we already said that that's a bit uncomfortable because relativity might have led you to think that there shouldn't be any superluminal causal influences. But even if you leave that aside and say, okay, well, I'm willing to allow superluminal causal influences, there's still a problem, which is that this is a fine-tuned model. So in particular, the no signaling property we saw said that B is statistically independent of X. As I vary X, I don't see any change in the statistics of B. So B and X are statistically independent. If there's a causal arrow here, then it means the only way I can achieve that independence is if the parameters of this model are fine-tuned. And so explanations that do appeal to a cause-effect relation have exactly that feature. The parameters in those models have to be fine-tuned to make sure that I can't turn that superluminal causal influence into a superluminal signal. Okay, so this X being independent of B is the no signaling condition. So this is a way of kind of making precise what the tension between allowing superluminal causes, even though there are no superluminal signals, you require fine-tuning to make that work. There are other explanations, there are other explanations of what's going on in the Bell experiment that don't involve superluminal causation. So one is, and we talked a bit about this, that you could rig the game so that the measurement setting is not random. So if there was a common cause of the measurement setting and the hidden variable, or a common cause of the measurement setting and the outcome on the other side, that could also allow you to, you know, win the game, generate the Bell inequality violations. But again, it's a fine-tuned explanation, because if you've got a common cause on X and B, then generically, for arbitrary choice of the parameters, you'd expect X and B to be correlated. But the no signaling condition says they're always uncorrelated. So I have to fine tune the parameters of this model to make sure that I get that lack of correlation. And then an even more radical idea for how to get out of Bell's theorem is that there could be retro causation, backward in time causation. So maybe you do get to choose the setting, you know, freely, but it reaches back in time and it influences the hidden variables. And it's the same thing here. Whatever you think about backward in time causation, this doesn't solve the fine-tuning problem, because you've set up a causal route from X to B. So generically, you'd expect them to be correlated. The only way to make sure they're uncorrelated is by fine-tuning the parameters. So in fact, you can show that there is no causal structure among the variables that can reproduce those statistics without fine-tuning. Right, so either it just can't do it at all, like the Bell causal structure, the common cause, or it requires fine-tuning to do it. So that's the bottom line, that the if you just take Reichenbach's principle, that the dependences need to be explained causally, and the no fine-tuning principle, you get a contradiction with these correlations, and therefore a contradiction with quantum theory and experiment. So it means you have to give up one of those principles. And they both seem like pretty good principles. So it's a difficult dilemma. Let me contrast it to the usual way of characterizing Bell's theorem. So usually people say we assume some sort of notion of realism, and it's always a little bit vague what's meant by that. We assume some notion of locality, which means that there aren't any superluminal causal influences, so we rule out those arrows across the experiment. We assume that there isn't any common causes of the settings and other things, and there's no causes back in time. So these are the usual sets of assumptions, sort of that they give you the options for how to escape the contradiction. You could give up on this one and say, I'm a Bohmian and I believe that there are superluminal causal influences. You know, collapse theories had superluminal causal influences as well. And other people think that we should instead, like Etuft thinks we should give up on superdeterminism and grant that settings are not really random. There are some speculative ideas about giving up on no retrocausation. So all I want to say to end is that what's nice about this characterization is that realism has been replaced by Reichenbach's principle. And coming back to the electron operationalism, I say, you know, one of the things you might not like about operationalism is it doesn't give causal explanations. So here in this version of Bell's theorem, we're just saying, look, correlation should be explained causally. That's what we're asking for. You know, so a sort of nebulous notion of realism is not needed. That's the only notion of realism you need, that we need a causal explanation of what's going on. And then this no fine-tuning assumption subsumes all these guys, because what we were able to show is that if you don't have signaling, then demanding no fine-tuning implies that you can't have superluminal influences, because the only way to have superluminal influences coexisting with no signaling is by fine-tuning. So we can use no fine-tuning together with just the observed no signaling properties of our experiment to derive locality. We can use no fine-tuning together with the observed no signaling to derive that there should not be these common causes of the settings and other things, and to derive that there shouldn't be these backward in time influences. So that's it. And let me just end with one note. I'm sorry I went over time. So personally, what I like to work on is the option of this implicit premise, which wasn't on the original list, which is that we should think of causal models as models where the graphs have these unobserved nodes that are described by classical variables, and our knowledge of those variables is described by classical probability theory. So personally, I like to think that, you know, we should hold on to the spirit of Reichenbach's principle and the no fine-tuning principle, and this is where we need to innovate. We need to grant that unobserved nodes could perhaps not be classical variables, and our knowledge of them not described by classical probability theory. So anyways, if you're interested in that route out, you can ask me about it. But yeah, that's the end of Bell's theorem. Thanks.